Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, I
don't,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to the game. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm here with the latest from an action-packed weekend of football. Here to discuss the big talking points, preceded of course with a handshake, are Alison Rudd, Tony Barrett, and broadcasting from beautiful downtown Mortlake, it's Matt Dickinson. Later on, I'll be asking my panel if they think the Hillsborough verdict can have an impact on the future of the game as well as its past. But let's start at the Britannia. Anybody want to say it's always a difficult place to go? No, I didn't think so. All right, so let's get straight into it. Stoke and City looks to me from the outside and from match of the day, if you're Manchester City, you view this as 2 points dropped given the Crouch basketball incident, the Balotelli elbow to the face, Ryan Shawcross off the line. Alison?
Yeah, well, it was interesting that Mancini said in quite a petulant way, why do we bother turning up? Why don't we just agree to get a point each and not bother going? Because obviously the effort of getting there and putting his players through three debutants and showing them what it's like to play at the Britannia, they probably do without it. But it's interesting. It's a mindset, isn't it, that I think increasingly a lot of the better clubs, so-called better clubs, have is that they go to the Britannia and I think they think they're probably only going to get a point. There's something about that place.
But it's weird though, because statistically, actually, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Stoke's home record isn't exceptional. In fact, I think there was one stage last season where they had a better record away from home than they did at home. I'm wondering if this like Britannia thing isn't some kind of myth. Is it, Tony?
I don't think, well, in terms of statistics, there is a myth, because I think there's plenty of teams when the Manchester United tend to do well there. But I think there is a psychological element to this. You go to Stoke, you know the kind of football you're going to come up against. You know it's not going to be an easy game. You know you're going to have to, you're not going to play well. I think that's the big issue. You know you're not going to be allowed to play the kind of football you'd like to. So all this kind of builds up into a myth. Yeah, it is to an extent a myth, because teams who go there and win, but I also think Stoke don't always get the credit they deserve. There are times when Stoke do stop the opposition from playing, but they also play some decent stuff themselves. I don't think that is one-dimensional as people have you believe. And it is one of those grounds that I think there are four or five in the Premier League that anything more than a point there is a good result. And I mean, that's obviously the teams outside the top four. If you get a point at Stoke, you get a point at Goodison, you get a point at Anfield, I think you're doing well. I think these are kind of teams that aren't necessarily in the elite, but they're going to give it a tough game at the home ground.
Andy Gray's to blame, isn't he, for coming out with that? Was it the old line about would Messi do it on a cold night? He seems to have sort of stuck in the. But I think maybe the mistake, I mean, in some ways, Tony said it there about, you know, teams worry that they're going to be able to play their game, and I mean, it's almost as if they're altering their style purely. To sort of counter something that Stoke may or may not throw at them. I think maybe there's a, you know, the mistake is made before too many teams even turn up there by altering their philosophy.
Okay, but all that said, Asmir Begovic made some ridiculously good saves. There was the unpunished Balotelli elbow to the face. I know it's all these Mario, but it doesn't mean he can get elbowed in the face. But most of all, there was this absurd Peter Crouch decision. Now, I don't want to pick on referees, But frankly, when they have absolute stinkers, I think we have to recognize that these people aren't good. And it's frustrating to think that there's people who invest a lot of time and money, and whether it's the fans or the owners or whatever else, to have the best players and best managers, you know, possible in the Premier League. And then you get situations like this. And Alisson, you're the designated defender of all things referees. How can you not spot two handballs in one sequence when the guy's 50 feet tall and you're standing 3 feet away? Well, what's he looking at?
Well, I honestly didn't think it was that obvious until Peter Crouch admitted it. I thought it was doubtful that it was technically handball at all. He's all gangly. His arms and legs, the ball was bounding all
no
over the place.
The fact that you're uncoordinated doesn't mean you can handle
but
the
it
ball.
But visually, that makes it difficult. Because the ball's bouncing everywhere, shoulders, chest, knees, isn't it?
You said, I mean, you know, if he didn't see it, he didn't see it. I mean, you know, you can argue, obviously.
No. Hang on a second.
But their referees are coached to be in the right position. They're coached to be looking, you know, in the right place. But you know, ultimately, it was a crowded box, load of bodies. The guy is snaking through, you know, whether it's with foot, hand, or whatever. He's snaking through, say, a particularly crowded box. You know, there are easy measures of officiating incompetence, but the ability to necessarily be in the perfect position to see that is not necessarily one of them.
Yeah, but Dicko, I appreciate what you said there about he's in the right position and everything, right? But he said if he didn't see it, he couldn't see it, so let's give him a pass. I'm sorry, there's a reason like Wayne Rooney plays up front for England and you don't. You can get all the same coaching and be as fit as Wayne Rooney potentially, but Wayne Rooney's a better footballer than you. And so clearly there are better referees than Mr. Clattenburg.
There would still be occasions when Wayne Rooney would miss a chance or misplace a pass that even Dicko, me, Alisson, or you could make. That's the human element of football, which any referee can have a perfectly good game, but for one split second can make a really terrible decision that changes the game. And that's the thing, obviously, we all focus on. But I just think it's... I looked at two of the penalty decisions of the weekend that were given and both could have went either way. And I just think refereeing is becoming incredibly difficult decisions like this are going to become more and more apparent.
I'm amazed Gab is picking on that. I thought it was a difficult thing to spot.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Well, to pick on a referee who sees something and makes a colossal error of judgment or interpretation, not whether he's got X-ray specs or not.
Well, I just kind of feel, and this is obviously a debate for another time, but if part of the success of the Premier League is in the fact that it's attracted some of the best players from all over the world, some of the best managers from all over the world, regardless of where they're from, I'm wondering if at some point we make the debate, should they just go and say, okay, these are the 10 best or 20 best referees that we can possibly get, regardless of nationality, and we're not going to go and have a quota system and we're going to reserve our spots in the Premier League and our sort of and those jobs for the boys who happen to be English. I wonder if we're going to reach that stage at some point and whether we should. It just seems strange to me that if you're a plumber from Hungary, you can come to London and you can work as a plumber. If you're a referee from Hungary, even you might be Victor Kassai, be one of the best in the world.
We don't want any of your match fixers coming over, is that
you say,
right?
No. I will keep the Italian match fixers out of it. But
you're presupposing there's such a thing as the perfect referee.
No. I am presupposing that there are better referees than other and worse referees, and that better referees get fewer decisions wrong than worse referees.
That's right. But I always come back to. Simon Barnes has always written this about referees, which is just. I mean, obviously the fact that there's only one or two goals in football compared to, you know, other sports with, you know, basketball, rugby, etc. With far more points, always puts far more attention inevitably on, you know, decisions around goals. That's one thing. Two, it's an impossible job. The game's got, you know, so much quicker. The idea that you can see everything is just ridiculous. It's just impossible. And then add the sort of football's partisanship, the natural sort of controversy that we love to generate around the game that stirs so much interest, and the whole thing just gets completely overblown. I mean, yes, do we wish the standard of refereeing was better? Yes. Can we probably find better referees in Denmark, Germany? Quite possibly. But I think you are making a mountain out of a small mistake.
Let's go back to the game. Tony, big deal was made of the fact that there were three debutants for Manchester City, Javi Garcia, Sinclair, and Maicon. Javi Garcia obviously scored the equalizer for City. Of those three, who do you think is going to have the biggest impact this year?
I still think Maicon's a signing that doesn't make sense in so many ways. I look at him and I look at what Manchester City already got in that position. I see Zabaleta, who I think is possibly their best defensive right-back, and Micah Richards. So I don't see where he fits in, but if he shows the kind of form he displayed it into 2-3 years ago, then maybe it could be him. I haven't seen enough of Javi Garcia. I've got to be honest, he's a player I've only seen bits of in the Champions League. He looks a good enough player, but who's the third one you mentioned?
It's a young gentleman named Scott Sinclair.
Scott Sinclair. Well, that's another one again that I think that one goes down as one for the list, an Englishman for the list. He doesn't seem to be the kind of player that Manchester City would normally go for. So, of the three,
Maybe Sinclair, the thinking is they don't have that many genuine wingers at City, and so with AJ gone, you know, you bring another guy who is more of a legit winger.
I think he will be a like-for-like replacement for AJ. I think he will be another bit part player winger. I think that's what he'll be. And I think he's signed for Mancini, a manager who doesn't necessarily utilise his kind of player that often. So if I think Maicon's got the best chance of the three, but more because he's got a manager who likes working with him than the fact that he might be the right player for City at this time.
Two more points. Michael Owen is such a huge story that even though we talked about this last week, we need to talk about it again because there's a different cast of characters on the podcast since we're having those nice, efficient whip rounds. Michael Owen made his cameo. Is he good for Stoke or will he just go and mess up what kind of already works with Walters and Crouch and Alisson? I'm looking at you.
If he can be fit enough, he's bloody brilliant for Stoke.
Michael
Owen is a class player, a star. He's amazing, amazing. I just don't know quite how fit he is.
All right, Tony, do you want to join in the celebration of Michael Owen and how amazing he is?
I think September 2010 was the last time Michael started for the game. I think that it tells a story. If Michael can come off the bench in a few games and score a few goals, he's worth whatever it is they're paying.
But why would you bring him off the bench, though, if you were Tony Pulis, right? So you've got people who, I mean, John Walters is, I think, a limited footballer, but I think he really thrives in that system. You have other strikers there who Pulis bought and spent money on. He's got Kenwyn Jones, who he no longer likes. He's got Cameron Jerome, who he also spent money on, who, you know, I think probably doesn't like so much anymore either. But I mean, they're all a certain type of striker. Now you go for
they're all light for light, though, aren't they? I mean, Owen is just, you know, even Stoke need a plan B, don't they? So you know, much as Pulis has made a great strength of a certain style, and he's a very good coach at what he's done. But the fact is, yeah, you know, any team needs some variety, and Michael Owen is offering that. And as Alisson says, if he's fit, he's offering a potentially very high-class variety.
Might I suggest, though, that Dicko, that Tony Pulis never saw the need to have a Michael Owen type in his team before?
Yeah, but then, you know, Stoke, he clearly wants to progress. Maybe he's challenging himself as a coach as well to see how he can make it work. I mean, I think maybe he's opening his eyes to new horizons.
We need to give a shout-out to Ryan Shawcross, who I don't know that he had he made an incredible clearance for Stoke. I don't know that he had his best game against City, but I've seen him play really, really well. I'm just wondering, why does his name never really get mentioned for England?
It does. They sing it every time at the Britannia.
Outside of Stoke and Port Vale, perhaps.
Well, I think he should be there. I'm a big fan of his.
Tony, you've got the same barber as Ryan Shawcross.
I don't have a barber, Gabe.
Neither does he.
No barber for me. I just think that England are actually quite well off at centre-back. I don't think they've got a perfect group, but they've got a good group. Gary Cahill, John Terry, Phil Jagielka. I don't think they're struggling for centre-backs. I also think that Ryan Shawcross probably falls into that group of players who, and this is unfair, but it's the way things in modern football. He needs to move to a club that plays more regularly at a higher level in Europe. And once he does that, I think then he'll be considered. That's not fair, but I think that's the way it is.
Dicko, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought Tony's probably captured it sort of right in terms of sort of why he's not selected. There may be a certain degree of snobbery about where he's playing and just the fact that he hasn't been exposed to those tougher tests. I mean, England were, I thought, Lescott and Jagielka had their worst game together for England last week, and actually had me thinking, blimey, I can see why John Terry, why Hodgson picks Terry, sadly. But, I don't think Shawcross has done enough, or shown enough to leapfrog over them and Cahill.
Let's move on to Loftus Road now, QPR and Chelsea. Now we're going to engage in that strange media phenomenon where we all say, oh, we want to just talk about football. We don't want to talk about the handshake. And then we're going to end up talking about the handshake because that's what we do. And actually, I want to take a step back. Dicko, is it important to talk about the handshake?
Is it important at all? I think Dion Dublin, as you say, Dion, I think it was Dion Dublin last night, was on the message of the day talking about, don't want to sort of do it like the tabloids do, and then, you know, let's talk about better things while talking about the handshake for some considerable length of time. I guess it ticks the sort of classic pub argument. You know, people talk about, newspapers reflect that to a degree, and it gets people talking. I sat in the court case for the entirety of it, and so I feel quite strongly about it, and I understand why Anton Ferdinand did what he did or didn't do what he didn't do. I have full understanding of that, having sort of sat next to the Ferdinand family for a painful week. And I sort of think he made a decision on a point of principle. I mean, some people are talking about the petulance of modern footballers and how it sort of reflects terribly on the game, and how, you know, it shows sort of football at its worst. Well, why? I mean, here was a guy who was sort of put in a very difficult position. You can argue about the handshake itself, whether that should ever take place. But in Ferdinand's case, he made a decision on a point of principle, he's perfectly entitled to. I certainly support him in his actions or in what he didn't do on Saturday.
I guess where I fall down with this a little bit is, well, first of all, the whole issue of the handshake, I find it ridiculous when you've got managers and clubs saying they should just get rid of it. This was introduced by the Premier League. The Premier League isn't some weirdo star chamber sent down from the top of Mount Olympus. The Premier League is the 20 Premier League clubs, and they tell Scudamore what to do. Scudamore doesn't have some weird agenda to go and try to get everybody to shake hands. He may be obsessive compulsive, but not in that way. You know, if you as a club don't like it, get rid of it. It's there for a reason. It's there to show off or to send a certain message, which I think is actually a worthwhile message. But I think my trouble with the Anton Ferdinand thing is he's a professional footballer. The handshake is part of the pregame ritual in the Premier League now. It's part of the thing. Now, if you don't do it, you're not doing your job. Now, it's fine, and there are situations where I think it's appropriate that somebody puts down their tools and doesn't do their jobs. Doesn't do their job because they feel strongly about something. That's why we have strikes, and that's why going on strike isn't illegal, for example. But it feels to me that when a person goes on strike, whether it's a teacher or a cop or a miner or whatever, they face consequences, and they kind of go into battle from an industrial point of view or labor point of view. Here, he just doesn't shake his hand. And he goes on and plays his match just like that. It almost seems like he doesn't really have a stake in this. That there's no downside to not shaking John Terry's hand. Am I way off base on this, Tony, since you're probably the most lefty union lover here?
I just think it makes football supporters make moral decisions and judge players on moral grounds, because what we're saying is that it's sort of okay in a way for Anton Ferdinand to do it because he's the perceived victim, and it's not okay for Luis Suarez to do it because he's the perceived villain. And without wanting to go into the right and wrongs of those positions, and that's a debate for someone else to have, because I've had it up to here with it. I just think it takes people into the realms of value judgments, and that is where I become uncomfortable with the whole pantomime. These are footballers, they are paid to play football, they're not paid according to the value of their handshake or otherwise. And I just think we ask people who may not like each other, who may have a past with one another, who may have been in court with one another, to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. You wouldn't see Anton Ferdinand cross the street to shake hands with John Terry. So why would you ask him to do it before they play football? I just think it's an artificial construct. And the players are exposed
in
the
job, though. It's part of this great entertainment sort of construct that the Premier League football, top flight football, has become. That's part of the ritual. They're not having a kickabout five aside in the park. Going back to this issue, Alison. We're spending a long time on the handshake. Do you have anything? you're dying to say? Or can we get into the game?
No, I think Ferdinand has every right to shake or not shake the hands of whoever he wants to.
Even when he's at work?
That's not his job, is it? It's like, his job is playing football. I don't think the analogy quite works. It's not like he's saying, I'm not going to, there's going to be a little force field around John Terry and I'm not going to do anything football-wise within 5 metres of him. He's not saying that. He's just saying, I just feel I'd be a hypocrite if I shook his hand, so I'm not going to do it. His manager said, that's fine, don't do it if you don't want to do it.
It will fester and fester. We'll have handshake stories for the next 10 years. That's great. That's great. Let's hope they both play till they're 40 and we can still be writing handshake stories.
All right, my Tottenham Hotspur supporting producer Chris is making the gun to the head gesture, so we're just going to quickly blow through the right. One little thing on everybody's favorite Spanish striker. Is anything sinister in the fact that he appeared to disappear down the tunnel in a bit of a huff after his substitution? Or is it just Fernando being Fernando?
I'd be worried if I was Di Matteo. You know,
would you be worried or would you be happy because maybe he might not want to play again?
No, I'd be worried because at one minute, you know, Torres can't cope with the fact that he's not number one striker. Next minute, apparently he's having difficulty coping with the fact he is number one striker. It's just pathetic.
Tony, you got to enjoy the great man up close. Were there any signs of this, of this guy's state of mind in his first few years at Anfield when everything was going grey?
There was a substitution that was very famous at the time. Benitez took Torres off of Birmingham away, and there was mayhem afterwards because he'd taken Torres off after, I think, 54 minutes. And there was this idea, how could you replace Fernando Torres? And at the time, if you remember, Steven Gerrard had a very visible facial reaction, which the cameras picked up on. And at the time, Benitez was slaughtered for it. But Fernando Torres was abysmal that game, as he had been in a number of games previously. And the story revolves around Fernando, whether it was right or wrong to take him off. And I think this has helped create this kind of thing within Torres. He did... From that position on, he decided that he was too good to be taken off. And I thought that the action that you saw on Saturday was the natural extension of that. Fernando Torres has had people tell him he shouldn't be taken off. And that's despite his form, that's despite his fitness. He thinks he should always be on the pitch. He's too good to be taken off.
Final word on QPR. They've spent money. I think they were a bit unlucky. Fabio and Andy Johnson going down to some injuries in the first half in this game. Dicko.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app
or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are they going to stay up, and might they finish top 10, as some suggest?
I don't think they will finish top 10. I mean, so far it looks like they've spent an awful lot of money to climb from, you know, sort of 17th to 14th. I mean, I think Mark Hughes is still getting to grips with the squad. So many changes. There were changes in January. There were changes the summer before that. And I think it's going to take a while for him to make sense of it all. So I don't think they'll be in the bottom three, but I don't think they'll, I'd love to see that wage bill at some stage, because I think it will not necessarily reflect their league position.
Now, on to our debate this week. It's been nearly a week since the findings of the Hillsborough independent panel. If you follow their coverage, and that and the other media, it's obviously been an emotional time for a lot of people. Certainly, our boss Tony Evans has weighed in heavily on this. Tony Barrett, of course, as well. In case people haven't figured out, you're from Liverpool. You've also spoken and written quite eloquently about this. Moving forward on this, I want to throw out this sort of broader theme. Obviously, a wrong has been righted thus far, and we've uncovered some, or perhaps some might say, had confirmation of some pretty shocking things in terms of police cover up and law enforcement cover up over the years. Is something going to change going forward, or is it a case, Dicko, that the system actually works today in a way that it didn't work in 1989, and that because the system works, that's why we've been able to have the Hillsborough Independent Panel, and a cover-up on this scale involving football fans could not happen again, or would be very unlikely to happen again. Are you fairly confident of that, or do you think we just need to always be vigilant?
Well, in terms of the cover-up side, I think always need to be vigilant. I mean, you know, it's sadly not unique, is it? Miscarriages of justice happen. We know that, and they still happen. On that side of things, clearly we need to be vigilant. I mean, whether it affects football again in this way, I think obviously is highly unlikely, without wanting to sound remotely complacent. But clearly, you know, part of the tragedy of the great tragedy of Hillsborough was that it took that awful day to make the changes in stadium. I mean, there's been some incredibly powerful stuff written in the last week. I mean, some of the best journalism I've ever read. I must say, I mean, I feel sort of emotional even talking about it. I've read more pieces in the last week that have made me cry than I can ever imagine, than I can ever remember. And, I think it made all of us sort of look back to those days, you know, even at a small club like Cambridge United, where I watched, turning up at games in the 80s and fights left, right and centre and stones being thrown over your head. And, you know, even at Cambridge, nice, sleepy Cambridge, it was sort of pell-mell, you know, just madness on afternoons. Made us all reflect on those days of just sort of what football was and how far it's travelled. And as I say, obviously they say the terrible tragedy is that it took the death of 96 people to make so many people sort of realise how wrong the culture was around football, and how then that affected how the police so appallingly handled the crowd at Hillsborough.
Tony?
I've spent the last few days, like a lot of other people, going through the findings of the Hillsborough Independent Panel. They're all available online, and I'll urge anyone who's got the time and the will to take the time to go through them, because there's some absolutely harrowing accounts. There's a document in which senior South Yorkshire policemen meet with their insurers and lawyers, and they actually talk about putting the responsibility on for opening the gate to the Leppins Lane, Gate C, onto a junior officer, Mr. Officer X, as they called him. This was conspiracy and cover-up, and the idea was that a junior officer would get into less trouble. He'd carry the can, but would get into less trouble than the senior officer. So it's these layers of cover-up and cock-up which absolutely disturb you. And for me, the reason why people have fought so hard for 23 years, as well as the anguish and the pain, is the feeling that no one has ever taken responsibility. There has never been a sense of accountability for Hillsborough. And for me, there's one man who symbolised that more than any other, and that's Graham Mackerel, who was Secretary of Sheffield Wednesday on the day of the disaster. And he actually told the Taylor Inquiry that he was responsible for safety. He was responsible for safety at Hillsborough on the 15th of April 1989. Graham Mackerel now works for the League Managers Association, but he also advises UEFA on venue management, i.e. stadia. This is somebody who resigned from West Ham United after they fielded an ineligible player in a League Cup game, and he said it wasn't his decision, but he had to take responsibility for the failing. He never saw fit to resign from Sheffield Wednesday for what went wrong at Hillsborough, a stadium he was in charge of safety for. And there's so many examples of people who failed in their duties at Hillsborough, failed terribly, and people lost their lives, who are now in positions of maybe even greater power and greater influence. And that's why the need for accountability is so great.
Well, Graham Mackerel isn't here to defend himself, but he's welcome to get in touch if he wants to. I'll just remind everybody who it was who was Graham Mackerel's boss, Dave Richards, of course. Sir Dave, as some people like to call him. I want to throw something out there. I want to get you guys on this. Tony, I'll come to you in a minute because I read what you wrote about this issue, about the FA. Ditko, you've been closer to the FA than probably most of us over the years. I want to understand what happened when the FA issued that really callous or what read like a callous, lawyerly, horrible statement the other week, and then David Bernstein had to come out and, you know, show a much more human expression of sorrow and regret for Hillsborough. Was that just a screw up, or is it a case that the FA fear legal action, and so the lawyer said, no, you mustn't say anything that might suggest, you know, an admission of responsibility?
I haven't sort of been briefed at any length by anyone there, but I can only think that it was well, you said it, a screw up. There are good people at the FA, good sort of I don't necessarily like using the phrase, but football people, and well, just you know, sane, well-meaning individuals who I think will probably look back with a fair degree of embarrassment about how that was handled, because they're better than that. Like you say, to sort of have to do it sort of in two bits, and to sort of back up a, as you say, like a sort of a statement that looked like it had been written by lawyers, you know, rather than people, sort of sentient beings, trying to empathise and sympathise with the situation was just plain wrong. And Bernstein, you know, did his best to retrieve the situation, but I can understand why the families felt it was, you know, very badly handled. And to say, I'm surprised, because the FA get a lot wrong, and a lot we disagree with, and a lot we put holes in. But they normally handle a situation like this far better.
Tony, obviously, you wrote a piece. Do you think the FA are vulnerable to legal action at this point because of events in 1989? Or is there some kind of statute of limitations on this? Is that why they reacted the way they did?
It's funny you should ask that. That's an issue I'm going to be speaking to a solicitor about later today, and someone who's an expert in this field, because there is a feeling that it may well be out of time, that the FA will, for want of a better phrase, get away with it. Their involvement is now, it's apparent to everyone. But it was the thing that irritated me most is their failings were apparent on the day of the disaster. Everyone knew then that the FA put an FA Cup semi-final in the stadium, that didn't have a valid safety certificate. There was no apology in the days afterwards, and that you have to wait until the day after an independent panel report reveals everyone's failings. I think that says a lot about the FA and their attitude towards Hillsborough. Kevin McKenzie made an apology before the FA, and I think that puts it into its proper perspective. If Kevin McKenzie's beaten you to the punch on an apology, you're going badly wrong somewhere. So I, for me, the apology counted for very, very little. David Bernstein did at least contain the word sorry. It was an undeserved apology, as he put it. But I think what people want to see is holding up of the hands from the Football Association and an acceptance that their failings played a big part in people dying at a football match.
You probably need to speak to a corporate manslaughter expert to know whether the FA as a body can be, the current management can be held responsible, or whether you, how, I don't know how you progress that. Have you, when you've been investigating, Tony, have you found out who, if you go down the corporate manslaughter path, who you aim that at the FA?
This is something that Michael Mansfield's looking at the moment. I don't think he has the answers as yet. And if he hasn't, then I certainly haven't. He's, I spoke to Michael after the press conference on Wednesday, and he basically said to me that everything was on the table. He said absolutely everyone who's failed in any way, they will be looked at and examined, but the legalities of it are still to be determined. I know the families have written to the Attorney General today. The first move is to try and get the original inquest verdicts quashed. And I think from that point on, you will see the relevant legal moves. But it's very, very difficult because, as has been said, it was a different regime. It was a different FA. And for this reason, I would like to see the likes of Graham Kelly, who is still around. I'd like to see him be made accountable. I'd like to see him stand up and give his version of events and say exactly what went wrong and why it went wrong. In one sense, I do have some sympathy with David Bernstein. This wasn't on his watch, but there are people who are around who it was on their watch, and it's up to them to take responsibility even more than it is up to David Bernstein.
But where did it go? I mean, I mean, on this point, Tony, I mean, it's what is Michael Mansfield after now? I mean, is it? I mean, is there if there's legal action, is it for money to help the families? Is it for you know, a degree of anger that therefore needs a certain retribution? Is it because there's a fear that the people who were thoroughly incompetent, you know, that all those years ago may still be, you know, in positions of great responsibility and should be forced out of those positions? I mean, or is it all three of those things?
I think the fact that the fines were so extreme, there was no one involved in at any level of the campaign who expected the cover-up to be as extensive as it was and to involve so many people. The fact that the South Yorkshire Ambulance were involved, I think that was one of the most shocking things. And that people are desperate for accountability. They want to see the people who covered up what happened to Hillsborough Door to account. I don't think anyone's in it for money, certainly not the people I've come across. Just to put that in perspective, the families, when the inquest, when the legal process was being gone through 10, 12, 15 years ago and longer, they were paying all their own bills. The police were getting their legal bills paid by the state. I don't think there's ever been a financial element to this, but there is a thirst for justice, and whether you want to put that down to vengeance, I wouldn't go that strong, but I can certainly understand why families feel that they want their day in court, that they want people to be held responsible for what happened to Hillsborough. I spoke to a survivor, and he said to me he wants the police officer who pushed them back into the pen when he was trying to escape, he wants to see him in court. And I think that's perfectly understandable, because that, I mean, obviously the lad survived, but had he died, is that not a case of manslaughter? I'm not a legal expert, but there seems to be a lot of people out there who got a lot of things wrong who are yet to answer for their failings.
But presumably, the new inquests have to come first before you progress things such as manslaughter. On the new inquest, you spoke initially, Gab, about moving forward. What I think would be great would be if from the new inquest we discovered that there was a lot of heroism among the people who died, which I think has been lost. The only people I know who were at Hillsborough that day, the girl that I knew, she survived because a bloke lifted her above his head and so she could get out, and she's pretty sure he died doing it, or died soon after doing it. And I think if you're the family of that man who died, who did that, you want to know in black and white that he died being a hero, not a scumbag hooligan.
I think when something like this happens, I think it's the duty of the survivors, the witnesses, and, you know, those who experience the aftermath from afar to hopefully learn as much as they can to make sure that stuff like this never happens again. Time now for some quick hits. Manchester United pummel Wigan, but the real story is the two new faces in Sir Alex's squad. Alexander Butner rampages down the flank and scores a gem of a goal. And Nick Powell also gets on the score sheet and has Sir Alex Ferguson comparing him to none other than Paul Scholes. Dicko, was Sir Alex right all along, or are we all just getting a little bit carried away?
I thought Butner looked powerful down the left. I mean, Evers needed a break, and Butner, you know, looks a great, potentially a very good replacement. Powell is a classy, looks like a classy little player, sort of coming just behind the striker, but none of this answers the big hole in the central midfield, which I still think is a big problem.
Arsenal were written off by some in the summer, but they coolly slammed six past Southampton. And were it not for a brain fart from Szczesny, they would have kept yet another clean sheet. Alison, are the Gunners for real?
Well, thank you, first of all, for the phrase brain fart. That's lovely. It's interesting. I mean, Wenger seems to think that, or seems to be arguing that now they don't have the focal point of Van Persie, they're a better team for it because the goals will come from everywhere. And if that is true, that's a new mindset and they are prepared to start scoring freely and not be scared to shoot, then they are the real deal. But it was against a team that looked almost couldn't believe they were there. So let's see if they can score from everywhere against teams that are more assured in the Premier League.
Tough day for Messrs. Gorks and Pierce. Tony, as I'm sure you're aware, Liverpool have avoided their worst start in more than a century by earning a share of the spoils at Sunderland. Is this a real improvement? And also, because he got slaughtered for it on television, was that actually a dive from Luis Suarez, or was it more of a non-call?
I think on the improvement side of things, I think it's a telling indication of Liverpool's mediocrity that, you know, look at a 1-1 draw to Sunderland, in which they probably should have won but didn't, as a sign of improvement. This was Liverpool of last season, Liverpool dominating games, not taking chances. I don't see it as a pronounced improvement. I just see it as it's par for the course, it's what they are and it's where they are. On the dive, when I was watching on television, and my first instinct was dive. I that was the first thing I shouted, dive, and I texted a friend of mine and said, that's a bad dive. I was absolutely adamant. And then they slowed it down at half time and showed 50 different angles, which suggested there may be actually two points of contact. It's whether it was enough to send them down, I don't know, but I just think that we're now in a situation where a player goes down in the box, he now gets booked or a penalty's given. There doesn't appear to be scope for referees to say, actually, it's impossible to say what happened there. He mightn't even know what happened. We know he's gone down. We know there's an attempted challenge. I'm not convinced it was a penalty. I'm not convinced it was a dive. Let's wave play on and get on with the game.
Harry Redknapp appeared to have a go at Andre Villas-Boas when he talked about BS and 70-page dossiers, but AVB shook it off and Spurs rolled a 3-1 win at Reading. Dicko, you sat down with Harry. Was he really taking a pop at AVB?
Well, Harry didn't name AVB when he talked about managers with thinking they're young and clever and geniuses, just as he definitely did not mention Daniel Levy when he talked about never, ever wanting to work for a chairman who thinks he knows the best about transfers. So obviously he did not mean to refer to either of those two gentlemen, if their lawyers are watching or listening. I think AVB should be very happy he's got Harry's job. He's left him with a decent team. His chairman has made some half-decent signings for him. I think that he just needs to get on and not worry about playing the media games and get his team in shape.
To be fair, Dicko, it's you and I in the muckraking media who asked Harry those provocative questions and then took Harry's answers to AVB.
I know. I did wake with a start when I saw that on the back page this morning because I thought, hey, Harry never even mentioned AVB. I don't know where people get this idea that when he talks about young, clever dick managers, he could possibly be referring to.
Now you go rake some more muck. Dimitar Berbatov, Alisson's favorite player, scores two as Fulham beat West Brom 3-0. Alisson, you on the Berba bandwagon yet? And could he be the signing of the summer?
I think he's the signing of history, according to y'all, isn't he? As far as the club's concerned. Well, it started very well. Started very well indeed.
Yeah, George Best, Rodney Marsh.
But it started very well. And it was a joy to watch Berbatov, actually, because he does that whole strolling around thing. And you think, And then suddenly he's class act, eye for goal, clinical penalty, actually worked quite hard, was often found defending in important situations. So it was a beautiful home debut. He said he was happy. Yol nearly cried with joy at how well it had gone. The key, I suppose, is whether Berbatov can cope with the fact that Fulham away from the Cottage are a different beast, and that might ruin the fairy tale, I think.
Aston Villa get their first win of the season as they beat Swansea 2-0 to bring them crashing back to earth. Two newcomers steal the show as Matthew Loughton nails a screamer and Christian Benteke comes out looking like the kind of Belgian forward Romelu Lukaku was supposed to be. All well now for Paul Lambert, Tony?
I'm not sure, because if you look at the squad, it's great to say if there's not a great deal there. And a lot of people point fingers at Alec McLeish and Martin O'Neill and other Villa managers for that, but I just wondered about Randy Lehner's role in all this and whether he's invested as he should have done Aston Villa, and now they're not even competing for Europe, and I don't think there's any way they'll do that this season. Again, I look at the squad and I can see them battling against relegation. I just don't think you've got the necessary quality to go any higher.
Gab, I'm guessing you don't want to talk about Mourinho every week, but Real are looking weak and making headlines for the wrong reasons. Explain.
No, in fact, Alison, I love talking about Mourinho every week. In fact, I could go Mourinho 24/7. No, I thought it was quite surprising. They lost at the weekend again to Seville. It's their worst start in 10 years. They're now 8 points behind Barcelona, which means that even if they win all the Clásicos, that they no longer hold their fate in their hands. And what was remarkable was Mourinho came out and said, right now I don't have a team. We are disjointed. And there are two or three players here who aren't pulling their weight and they're thinking about other things. I just can't imagine it would ever be good for a manager to say something like that, because all it means is the media will now speculate on who those two or three players are, which surely can't be good. Then again, he's a special one and I'm not. And maybe there is a logic. Maybe once again this is the kind of thing only he can pull off, and maybe he is pushing the right buttons with his teams. I don't know. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun, and it's been real. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can also, of course, go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, including my excellent column. I don't know, I doubt any of you three have read it today, but it takes you all the way to the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. There you go. Okay, judging from your reaction, nobody's bothered to read it. So, whatever. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.